Today on Peace Talks Radio, we learn about community-based violence intervention programs.
And that's really what CVI is about. It's individuals who are handing forward so that their children, the elderly, their spouses can have an opportunity to live in a community where they don't have to worry about dying every day. That's not a civil right, that's a human right. Or children have a right to go to school without thinking about how can I navigate to get to school without being shot. And that's really what CVI is about.
Stay with us for a discussion on gun violence prevention from people doing the work. That's today on Peace Talks Radio. This is Peace Talks Radio, the radio series and podcast on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, today with correspondent Emily Cohen. The United States has one of the highest rates of gun violence in the world. And many years of late, gun violence has been the leading cause of death for children in the U.S. Yet, few issues are as politically polarizing as gun policy. While a few specific policy proposals garner bipartisan support, the partisan divisions on other proposals, and even on whether gun violence is a serious national problem at all, have grown wider over the last few years. How can we find common ground over common sense solutions to gun violence? And what solutions are already working to address this devastating problem? On today's Peace Talks Radio episode, correspondent Emily Cohen explores solutions to gun violence, speaking with people working to address this issue on the streets, in academia, and in policy advocacy. We hear from Rodney Phillips, Billy Deal, James Mitchell, and Nidra Turner of the Metropolitan Police Initiatives about their outreach work in the community violence intervention space on the streets of Chicago. Later, we'll speak with Nick Wilson, the Director of Gun Violence Policy at the Center for American Progress.
We need to rethink accountability because just locking everybody up for a long time doesn't seem to be working. We need to look at how do we do restorative justice and how do we do the healing. So there's so much pain and trauma in these communities that are plagued by gun violence. And so we really encourage everyone to come to the table and put everything out there from accountability to prevention.
Wilson gives perspective on the national trends around gun violence and where we are seeing the most promise around reforms and public safety. But first, we'll hear from Chico Tillman from the University of Chicago Crime Lab. Dr. Tillman is the director of the Community Violence Intervention Leadership Academy, which trains people working in violence intervention in cities across the U.S. Dr. Tillman came to his work to try to change his community in a positive way. And he speaks about the mission of violence intervention and the way it interacts with other institutions, including policing.
Well, community violence intervention is a complementary strategy to policing and a complementary component in the public safety ecosystem where individuals deal with individuals at the highest risk prior to them committing a violent act.
Can you talk about the gap that you are trying to fill with police departments?
When you think about situations in community, most violent crimes happen because of interpersonal conflict. However, if police are called during an interpersonal conflict, typically they are, when they arrive, they tell the individuals to disperse. What's problematic about that is that the issue isn't resolved and typically it surfaces again as soon as the police pull off. Well, individuals in community violence intervention work with those individuals to resolve the conflict so that it doesn't result in end in a shooting or a homicide.
How do the interventionists get introduced into the community? What is that dynamic?
Well, the key is when we recruit individuals to work in this field, we recruit individuals from the community that we service. CVI is place-based, so we work with individuals in vulnerable communities, and we recruit individuals from those communities that already have influence and relationships with individuals in the community. So it's not a new individual coming into the community trying to establish ties. It's people already in the community that already understand the community, the culture of the community, and have relationships with people throughout the community.
One of the challenges around community violence intervention has been professionalizing the field. Can you speak to that?
Many individuals started community-based organizations because a cataclysmic event. Someone was murdered in a community, could have been their their child, it could have been their loved one, it could have been a spouse. And individuals are tired of the violence in the community and they are moved to do something. What's problematic is even though they have access to the individuals and they're moved to do something, if you haven't been equipped to run a business or run an organization, there's going to be challenges around the organizational and operational part, even though you have access to this hard to reach population.
You just launched a leadership academy for community violence prevention and will be working with 21 cities. Can you talk about this program and how you selected those communities?
One of the beautiful things about working at the University of Chicago is that we are urged to be on the cutting edge of innovation and always searching, because we're a Research One institution, for gaps in the field. I was allowed or selected to be a part of the Biden-Harris transition team in terms of helping with a small group of people to find racial equity lens that can go throughout all departments. And when that happened, there was an onslaught of mass shootings. With that came the ARPA dollars that was dispersed to every city, county, and state throughout the United States. The problem with that was every city, county throughout the United States was not familiar with CVI or violence prevention tactics. So therefore, we needed to create an institution that would equip them with the knowledge to be able to even start a program.
So can you walk us through an example of what community violence intervention actually looks and feels like in practice?
I think the most important thing people need to know is 90% of our work is done when there's no incident. So if you think about it, I often use this analogy. If you wanted to stop smoking in the bathrooms at a high school, who would be the best ones to hire? The students. Why? Because the students already know who's smoking in the bathroom. And they could walk directly to the smokers and say, hey, they said no more smoking in the bathroom. They're hampering down on it. I've been called the bathroom monitor or whatever, and I'm coming directly to you and say, hey, don't come in my bathroom smoking. So when we hire interventionists, the interventionists already know who the individuals in their community that are at the highest risk, and they access them, they love on them, they give them opportunities to transition into a pro-social lifestyle by doing an assessment to see what they really need. Are you having challenges with housing? Is it education where you need a GED or a high school diploma or want to enroll in college? Do you want to get a trade? Do you want to get a job? Do you have mental health issues? After the assessment, we connect them with someone else in the ecosystem who specializes in the particular need that they might have.
So you're trying to provide the social supports for the person at risk because the theory is that the lack of those resources is at the heart of violence.
Well, really at the highest risk. The whole community is at risk of being shot. If there's in communities like the Austin community or Inglewood, where there's 100 to 200 people shot a year, everybody in the community at a risk of being shot because it's so normalized that people shoot in the community. The highest risks are the less than 1%. I want to say that again. Less than 1% are the drivers of violence. Sometimes we over-magnify the problem and say, and make it appear as though everybody is doing it in the community. No, it's less than 1%. So we're hyper-focused on that less than 1% to getting them services and getting them enrolled in programming such as cognitive behavior intervention to change the way they think about situational decision-making so they can make non-aggressive resolutions to problems and challenges.
I think the question on a lot of minds is the easy access to guns. What role does that play, and are you trying to address that on any level?
That's a complicated issue because we believe in the Constitution. so we don't infringe upon individuals' Second Amendment rights. But what we don't condone is illegal use of guns. Individuals who are not supposed to have guns. And the challenge with dealing with individuals at the highest risk who live in vulnerable communities, typically they have a past. And even if they're enrolled in a program and trying to change their life, the people who they might have had conflicts with may not be in the program. So what we do advise them to do is to limit their use of guns, to limit the people they hang around who are involved in those type of activities, and utilize different resources such as time management so that they don't put themselves in situations where using a gun has to be an option.
There's a new White House task force for gun violence prevention. What are your hopes for this?
It's super emotional, this whole thing, because this is something we have been fighting for since the inception of the Biden-Harris administration. The main thing I want them to accomplish is the permanency of CDI within the ecosystem of public safety. Four things that they said they would do would be to expedite the implementation of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. This is super important. Identify different ways the president alone can make executive actions to advance gun violence prevention or CVI or reduce gun violence. But also they said they'll use their platform for coalition buildings, not only within local cities, but across states. And I think that's huge in terms of standardizing practice across how we not only do the work, but how we measure the work, create metrics. And lastly, improve support for communities that's impacted by gun violence. I think this is huge. I think it sends a message to the rest of the country, the importance of the people who do this valuable work. And I think now it's time really for cities to galvanize people that do this work and figure out ways that they can work with other components of the public ecosystem to move the body of work forward.
Are there any cities that you would point to that have done a particularly great job with community violence intervention?
Yes, that's a great question. Anywhere that you institute a CVI component correctly, let me say that correctly, with that's resourced correctly, there would be a decline. And it's not rocket science, it's simple math. If you think about 10 people that's at the highest risk, if we want to go on a low end, three of them don't want to do that, looking for, you know, tired, fatigue, and want a different option. And that's without a lot of work. So there's going to be a decrease. Now you got an opportunity to get a job, to have something, to change your identity. I think what's critical is if we look at the work that's done in New York in particular and in California, at one point in the 90s, New York, Chicago, and LA all had violence at around 1,000 or more. However, New York went all the way down to 200 homicides a year, and they have 7 million people, three times Chicago. And LA went all the way down to 300 from 1,400. And the thread that we see is that they had a consistent flow of investment to CVI throughout the entire time that they implemented, and they saw results. Because what CVI does is work with individuals prior to something happened, and where police work with situations that have reached a level of crime. You attack them from a preventive and a responsive way.
Can you talk about the uptick in community violence since the pandemic and any pivots that you had to make as a result? Violence did drop in 2023 fairly precipitously in many places, but I'm curious to hear what lessons you learned during the spikes of 2020 and 2021 and how your programming changed.
First of all, let's look at this. The world changed since the pandemic. Most people went from the way they work in person to a lot of things went remote and never came back. So it was a big shift in the way the country does its day-to-day work, but also being limited in things you can access change the way people maneuver in society. And many of the people that work CBI had to shift the way they work because many of us were asked to support the CDC and really push the adherence to the guidelines more so than stopping violence. Because the preeminent or most important thing at that time was stopping the pandemic. So we spent a lot of time working on getting people vaccinated, teaching people about wearing masks, getting people to adhere to social distancing, and less about getting them into programming. That was secondary about getting them into programming about CBI, which is cognitive behavior intervention, to change the way they do situational decision making. Now, since the pandemic has died down, we're shifting back into focusing on violence prevention. But along with that was the uprising that came from the challenges with George Floyd. So we had two or three dynamics going on at one time. And now you're starting to see, such as in Chicago, a decline in violence since we have solely focused on stopping shootings and homicides.
How did you come to this work? What is your story?
That's a beautiful question. I am a person that's system impacted. I served 16 years, 3 months in prison. Unfortunately, 13 years was excessive under a draconian crack sentence. However, many people search for their purpose. In my case, my purpose found me. I had no idea that me being in federal prison and developing relationships with individuals at the highest risk from all over the country would become an asset. So when I came home, it was a gang war going on in the Austin community. And I knew both of the individuals involved, both of the groups from prison. One of the guys was my cellmate and another guy I grew up with and had spent some time in prison with. And when I resolved the issue, the euphoria, the feeling I had from saving lives and stopping people from dying was something that I had never experienced. And it was at that point I had an epiphany and realized this was the mission that God had for me for my life.
When was that?
That was in 2012. I came home in 2011. In 2012, I moved back to Chicago. And that's when I figured out what I was destined to do.
And since then, you've gone back and gotten an education.
I got a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and a PhD in criminology, law, and justice.
Well, is there anything else that you want to add or that you want listeners to know about this work?
I think it's so important that you appreciate individuals who are unarmed, but each and every day walk into situations where they can lose their life in order to make their community safer. And that's really what CBI is about. It's individuals who are paying it forward so that their children, the elderly, their spouses can have an opportunity to live in a community where they don't have to worry about dying every day. That's not a civil right, that's a human right. Everybody deserves to live in a healthy community where they're not concerned about dying, or children have a right to go to school without thinking about how can I navigate to get to school without being shot. And that's really what CBI is about. Another thing I want to say that's critical is CBI is not adverse to policing. We respect policing. We understand the need for policing. We understand that police have a role, and we want police to understand our role as well, that we work with individuals prior to them committing a violent act so that they fortunately don't have to have the interaction with police in the first place. It'll be our hope that police can focus, be hyper-focused on situations that need their attention that involve high violence or violent crime.
Well, that's an important point to make. It's probably something on many people's minds, especially with a lot of talk in the last few years about defunding the police.
Let me say that. Let me address that too. Defunding police or abolitionists is really a social work term. And many of the people that adhere to it are individuals in school that's thinking theoretically. But I taught yesterday at the policing lab, and I said the biggest challenge, or why we're even talking about defunding the police, is some way police have been removed from the fabric of community. And we have to realize that policing is a job. It's not a person. It's a job. And that that's just a profession, and that we got to humanize the people behind the badge and understand that this is a person in the community. And where we seeing that done the best is in small suburbs, where the police, when they say police, if your name is Joy, hey, how you doing, Joy? How's it going? How your kids doing? Because this is the person I grew up with. He know my children, and the way he police is different. But if you see yourself as something not a part of the community, that's when it becomes problematic. We have to bring police back into being a part of the fabric of the community, so that it's us all working together collaboratively, the same way we deal with COVID, to quell violence in our most vulnerable communities.
That was Dr. Chico Tillman of the University of Chicago's Community Violence Intervention Leadership Academy on Peace Talks Radio today. You can learn more about Dr. Tillman and conflict resolution at peacetalksradio.com online. Coming up, we'll hear a segment from a new podcast called Streets, Beats, and Peace on gun violence prevention efforts in Chicago. Hosts Billy Deal and Rodney Phillips talk with guests James Mitchell and Nydra Turner of the Metropolitan Police Initiatives about outreach work in the community violence intervention space. Host Rodney Phillips said he hopes to use his platform to educate people about CVI, community violence intervention, and reach people that he might not otherwise encounter in his work on the streets.
Today we'll be talking about a day in the life of an outreach worker. We know in the field, no 2 days are alike. Today we'll be featuring two of our best outreach workers, Nike and Lil James. They both come from the West Side communities, and they both is graduates of the Peace Academy, and they also field managers.
They are essential players in the community violence intervention field, or CVI space, and their efforts directly help to de-escalate confrontations, provide trauma-informed services, and most importantly, create lasting change in our communities. They're here today to talk about their typical day-to-day, how they got into street outreach work, and the efforts that they see in real time. Hello to both of y'all. Welcome to Streets, Peace, and Peace. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon. I'm happy to be here.
So, you know what I want y'all to do, describe in detail a typical day in the outreach field, because we know no 2 days is alike.
So Canvas is basically us walking the neighborhood. We're intentional about where we go. We try to go to at least where there's been a shooting or where it's likely to be high crime areas. Those are the places we want to canvas. We want to get out. We want to let the guys know we out there. Also let the neighbors know, you know, we out here. We here for support. And it build those relationships, man. You got to let people see you besides when it's going bad, but when it's going good. So canvassing, we real big on canvassing, getting out there, letting people know who we are and that we're here to support. Usually in the morning for I know for street outreach guys, for some of the guys in Austin. So what we do is we come in the morning, we check in, right? Check-ins usually look like us talking with each other, figuring out, hey, this happened yesterday, who we need to see, can we get a hold on this, who are we got good participants in that area, who got the best relationship in that area. And it's like a debriefing. So we do that. We also check on each other, right? Because we know this is a high stress job. This is dangerous. This is stressful work. So you want to make sure your team is good before they go out. So we check in with each other, man. We make sure everybody all right. And then we hit the streets. We figure out if it was an incident yesterday, if it was a shooting yesterday, then today we'll go through their cameras. Let's figure out, hey, do we know what happened? Can we get connections to the family? Let's see what type of service these people need. Let's you know, figure it out. That's what a morning looked like. As Nike was saying, pop-ups.
And we also go through the schools, the public schools and high schools in the community, try to get those high-risk youth that's up in the school system causing some of the problems in there. Like, a lot of them be fighting, meet up at the school and all that. So we show our presence out there as well. And, you know, build a relationship with them, too, and try to de-escalate all the conflicts that we could do up there.
Okay. So One thing I know about this work, you know, I was an outreach worker for like 15 years. It ain't your traditional job, so you have to be referred in. So I know crucial to the work is having an LTO, license to operate. So tell me, how did y'all get into work, and who referred you, and who mentored you in this work?
So before I started doing this, I was formerly incarcerated, so I was in a joint. I was in prison, and I'm calling home, and I got two good friends that like my brothers, and they was doing the work. And, you know, initially, I'm like everybody else. I know I ain't want to go back out and do this. I got friends. You know, I got people I know I love. They dying. The other ones that ain't dying going to federal prison. So I'm like, man, I got to do something. But what, right? And they telling me about what they was doing, and I ain't see it at first. I'm like, no, it's probably, you know, I'm gonna do something else. It ain't real. That don't work, you know, excuse my language. So I got out of prison, and it was a shooting at this gas station. And I remember I called them, and I'm like, hey, you know, I'm out. Y'all get up with me. And they like, man, we at this gas station. And they told me the gas station. I remember telling them, like, hey, y'all should get from up there. Somebody got killed there yesterday. And they like, man, that's why we here. You should come check it out. And when I went to see them, and I seen, like, the effect people had, like, how happy people were to see them. These are people who didn't use always take care of their community, you feel me? The community didn't always view them. And I got a chance to see people seeing them in a different light. And I'm like, all right, this is what I need to be doing. I've done so much to help contribute to the problem more than my share. So I just knew, like, man, I got kids. I can't be out here. People out here dying, these young boys out here dying, they killing each other. And I don't think you got a right to be like, hey, this shouldn't be happening, or this shouldn't happen to my kid. And then you don't make an effort, especially somebody who helped cause it.
Well, that was a clip from Streets, Beats, and Peace, a podcast on gun violence prevention in Chicago. One of the notable things that the clip highlights is how violence prevention work is led by people from within the community. And it is often people who were once involved in violence themselves who are now working to make things better for others. There's more about everything in our episode today at our website, peacetalksradio.com. And I'm series producer Paul Ingalls today with correspondent Emily Cohen. And coming up after the break, Emily speaks with Nick Wilson of the Center for American Progress. Wilson sheds light on the national trends around gun violence and where he is hopeful for common ground around gun policy reform. Before we close this part of the show from our Peace Talks Radio Peace Music Archive, here's a bit from Mark Arelli's moving song, cut with a host of his friends, called By Degrees. He's singing mournfully, "You can get used to anything when it happens by degrees, including, sadly, rampant gun violence in the U.S. He's hoping his song will shake us out of our apathy.
I've seen every head bowed down as if lost in private prayer. I've seen the phones in every hand, seen the long and vacant stares of souls gone numb, thumbing through each ceaseless change in fear. You can learn to live with anything when it happens by degrees.
I've seen talking heads shout back and forth across some great divide against a map of red and blue. Points of view so cut and dry, but when you look into the mirror, what color country do you see? Well, you can learn to live with anything when it happens by degrees.
Thank you.
This is Peace Talks Radio, the radio series and podcast on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, today with correspondent Emily Cohen. We're here with part two of Emily's exploration of how we can find common ground over common sense solutions to gun violence. And hear something about solutions that are already working to address this devastating problem in the United States. This time, Emily speaks with Nick Wilson of the Center for American Progress. And Wilson sheds light on the national trends around gun violence and where he's hopeful for common ground around gun policy reform.
If you had asked me 2 years ago, I would have been saying there probably isn't much progress that can be made in our polarized Congress. The role of money and the gun lobby is just so strong. But we saw a year ago that a bipartisan group of senators were able to come together and pass the first significant gun legislation in over 30 years, the Bipartisan Safer Community Act. That really took a holistic approach to reducing gun violence. It strengthened some gun laws, it closed some loopholes, but it also invested in the root causes of gun violence, whether that's more mental health counselors or more resources for students in schools, and as well as more money for community violence intervention. And so I think, you know, when we focus on any one individual policy, it's easy to politicize it. But when we look at so many gun policies that are supported by a majority of members of both parties and gun owners, I do think that there is more progress that can be built upon the Bipartisan Safer Community Act to strengthen some existing gun laws and allocate more money for community violence intervention, supporting gun violence survivors to break the cycles of violence, and making sure that our students and schools have the resources they need to prevent violence before it starts.
You did mention mental health. Research shows that only about 4% of violence in the United States can actually be attributed to mental illness. Yet there is seemingly a lot of talk about this as a solution and addressing mental health after mass shootings and other types of violence. What do you say to that?
Certain politicians, whenever they are confronted by gun violence tragedies, they will just scapegoat people with mental illness and say, oh, we just need to address that. These are some of the same leaders that then go ahead and defund all mental health services in their states and don't support those investments. I don't think that spending all of our time focusing on mental health will get us the reductions that we need. But I'm not going to go ahead and say that we don't have a problem with mental wellness in this country, whether it's after a gun violence incident where people are traumatized and impacted, they need supporting services. It's such a difficult time and difficult period to be a young person that we do need those more of those support services. Some of those may prevent someone from deciding to take their parents' gun and commit an act of violence at schools. But really, that's not enough. If we really want to get to reducing gun violence and make it so we're not the number one country with gun violence, it's going to take stronger gun laws like banning assault weapons and high capacity magazines. It's going to take stronger background checks. And it's going to be looking at the root causes of violence, whether it's poverty, structural disadvantage, or other lack of kind of opportunities and resources. But for us, we want to do all of it. President Biden and Vice President Harris announced several thousand new mental health counselors. And whether or not that does something on gun violence, it's still something that's great for our students and our schools because they need the supportive services to be successful in life.
So mental health and CVI do go hand in hand.
The cities that have the highest levels of gun violence, there is so much existing trauma. You know, when you talk to people like Chico and people on the ground, and everybody in these communities knows someone that's been lost to gun violence, someone that's been incarcerated, someone that has really struggled to get the services they need. And so there's a type of trauma reduction that we need to do. And we're working with advocates to make sure that everybody that is impacted by violence or trauma, they have a right to those supportive services. So it definitely goes hand in hand. But it's, as you say, it's important that we look at gun violence not altogether, but we look at the different types of gun violence. Domestic violence, gun violence has a much different set of policies than maybe youth suicides or mass shootings. And so we kind of look at the different policies and programs that are successful. And community violence intervention programs are really a promising way in Black and brown communities to really change the dynamics of violence and break those cycles.
Since 2019, firearms have been the leading cause of death in the U.S. for youth. And a lot of this is due to access to guns. This is what the facts tell us. But the facts and data behind gun violence don't seem to be changing hearts and minds or outcomes. Is that a fair assessment? And why do you think we're ignoring what the data is telling us?
I think one thing we hear a lot is after a mass shooting, we hear, oh, I can't believe that happened to us. I never thought that would happen here. I used to work in Maine, and every year we'd go to the legislator and say, like, if we don't pass basic foundational gun laws, we will have a mass shooting. We're not immune. And people wouldn't take us seriously. And then sure enough, there was a terrible mass shooting and manhunt in Maine, and people are finally listening. And, you know, Congressman Jared Golden, a Democrat who was against every gun law, including assault weapon ban, he took the remarkable step of saying he was wrong. And unfortunately, we can't wait until every congressman has been personally impacted by gun violence before we take action. A lot of times advocates like us, we talk about how for every dollar we spend on prevention, you know, we might get $10 back, $15 back, that we're saving money. And those economic costs work a lot when we talk about other issues. But for gun violence, for some reason, people are really just buying into the gun lobby myth that a gun makes you safer and only a good guy with a gun will keep you safe. And if that was the case, we'd have the lowest levels of gun violence because we have more guns than anywhere. But that's just not the case. But I do think that the younger generation aren't falling for these gun lobby lies. They see right through it and they're calling them out. And I think we're building momentum and putting pressure on Congress to do something. But as you said, in this polarized state, it's really hard to get anything done in this Congress.
Well, speaking of the gun lobby, Wayne LaPierre is stepping down from the leadership of the NRA. Does this change the influence that the organization has politically?
The NRA has been really on a steep decline since 2016. They put in $50 million to help elect President Trump and a Senate and to influence the Supreme Court. But I think a lot of what they were pushing for decades, very strategically, is now mainstream. These myths I said of, you know, you need a gun to protect yourself. You know, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, the other major gun lobby, would hire these PR firms on Madison Avenue to say, oh, how do we sell more guns to women? Well, make them afraid and say the only way to prevent them from being attacked is to have a gun. Or how can we get more African-American men to carry guns? Oh, let's talk about all the white supremacists that have guns. And so these scare tactics are alive and well in this country.
Something else that we aren't often talking about, but I think many people are aware of, is that gun violence in the United States is nearly entirely perpetrated by men. 80% of homicides are committed by men. 98% of mass shootings are committed by men. Even shootings by law enforcement are majority men. Why are we not talking about that more?
If you talk to any gun violence prevention advocate that's worked in a state house or the local level, they'll tell you that there's this extreme toxic masculinity that is happening. You know, I've been in state houses where they'll come and they'll film you and they'll spit on you and they'll try to provoke you in their Gun Save Lives t-shirts with their assault weapons on their backs. And it's really hard to engage in kind of civil debate, and people are rightfully scared to sometimes speak out. But at the same time, we know that, you know, in rural Maine, we knew there were going to be layoffs at the shipbuilding yard. We would send suicide prevention advocates because we knew that all of a sudden there would be an uptick of men going into the woods and having a hunting accident or, you know, taking their own lives, because the role of men are changing, especially with older men. I think we need to have a conversation about what the role of firearms is when men are, there's something going on with these men and with young men. Even, you know, recent polling has shown that more younger men are becoming more conservative and really diverging from Gen Z women. And I think it's something that we really need to think about. But we talk about America, but there's really six different kind of regional cultures with their own backgrounds. And we really need to meet people where they are and understand the cultural dynamics and the local dynamics. And whether it's mental health or economic opportunity or rethinking the role of men in this society, we need to have that conversation. But in the meantime, we need to encourage folks, gun owners, if their friend is, you know, going through a divorce, going through a layoff, they're going through a tough time, you don't need to call the cops. We don't need to confiscate weapons, but you need to say, hey, can I hold on to your guns for a while? I'll put them in my safe next to mine. When you're feeling better, we'll go out hunting. But it really can't be just passing stronger gun laws and asking law enforcement to handle this. We need to have peer-to-peer, family member to family member, taking away these lethal means while they work through these difficult issues.
I guess that gets to my next question. So many people in the U.S. own guns, and probably many people listening to this interview own guns. If there was one piece of advice you would want to give to a gun owner, what would that be?
An excellent question. We talk a lot about what is a responsible gun owner. I was raised as an Eagle Scout. I used to run rifle ranges, and I've always kept my firearms locked in a gun case. Trigger locks are fine temporarily, but I think having a real safe is much more important, making sure that the ammunition, it's stored separately, that the gun's not loaded, making sure that if you have children in the house especially, that you might think that they don't know the combination or where you put it, but they probably do and they will find it. And there's so many tragedies of 1-, 2-, 5-year-olds finding their parents' guns and either bringing it to school or having an unintentional shooting. So those are like the real basics, but I would say a responsible gun owner goes further and that they go through training. They understand the gun laws and how they're changing. They make sure that they, when they're cleaning a gun or handing it to someone, that there isn't a round in the chamber. That's really one of the fatal mistakes that we see a lot. And making sure that they don't sell a gun to somebody or give a gun to somebody that might be prohibited. They might have a protective order against them and they might be want to use that gun to kill a domestic partner. And so making sure they go through a background check, even if it's not required in their state, to make sure that they're not arming somebody that wants to go off and cause harm to the community.
With gun reform largely stalled in Congress, several states are looking to tighten their gun laws through ballot initiatives this November. Can you talk about the role of ballot initiatives in addressing gun control and why there is this shift?
You're right that a lot of the action and excitement is really happening at the state level. We're really seeing two Americas emerge where states that already have foundational or decent gun laws really are building upon those and passing a lot stronger gun laws. States like Colorado jumped up in the rankings of stronger gun laws very high this year by passing multiple gun laws. Places like New York, California continue to strengthen their gun laws, while places like Alabama and Georgia keep removing the few gun laws they have, such as now in those states, you don't need to have a permit, you don't have to have a background check to be able to carry an assault rifle or a handgun concealed anywhere you want. And elections really do matter, where we're seeing places like Michigan and Minnesota really pass really strong gun laws and seeing their gun violence rates go down. Ballot initiatives were really popular for a few years after Sandy Hook. I think around 2016, there were a couple of ballot initiatives that failed either at the ballot box or in implementation, especially Nevada and Maine with their background check campaigns. And so we hadn't seen a lot of action, but then Oregon, just over a year ago, were able to pass several really important gun laws, including permit to purchase at the ballot box with a ballot initiative. And so we're seeing a lot more renewed interest. You know, they're expensive. They take a lot of work. You have to make sure you word the policies correctly, because it's hard to change them later. But we're really seeing that's one way to cut through the money that the gun lobby is being able to spend to purchase these politicians, that you can really go straight to the people, to the voters, where all of the gun laws that we advocate for here at the Center for American Progress have majority support by members of both parties, by swing voters, by gun owners. So these are very popular. So that's why the ballot initiative process is so important, taking it directly to the voters where the gun lobby doesn't have as much sway.
So are you seeing ballot initiatives from both the gun rights side and the gun reform and gun control side?
We haven't seen as many significant ballot initiatives from the pro-gun side. That could always change, but the gun lobby has been more successful at co-opting these state leaders. I don't think it's the most effective way. We encourage states to go through the democratic process that's been built and focus on winning gun safety majorities to pass these through. But sometimes you do it the right way and governors or speakers of the House will stop it. And then you have to go to the people. I am encouraging Maine this year to go through the process. Some of the legislators have, after their mass shooting, have promised to relook at the weak gun laws in the state. But if they are unwilling to do that, they should go ahead and say, all right, if you're not willing to do it and represent the will of the majority of Maine voters, then we're going to take it directly to them. So I think that's just an extra tool in the toolbox.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add for listeners to think about in terms of the progress that we are making or that we can make to find common ground to address gun violence in the U.S.?
For so long, it was considered the third rail politics, something that we would talk about maybe in the primary and not in the general election. We wouldn't bring it up when politicians' careers are on the line. But just looking at President Biden, Vice President Harris, they're all in on talking about gun violence as a pillar of this election season. We're seeing so many, not only federal officials, but senators and governors talking about the need to support gun violence survivors. And so I think it's really changing. And for so often, people will get hung up on one policy issue and look at things in isolation. But we really encourage people to look at gun violence across accountability and prevention framework. We need to invest in community violence intervention programs. We need to invest in communities and their capacity, and we need to invest in our young people. We also need to hold the people that are driving violence accountable. We also need to hold law enforcement and our courts and others accountable for doing their job to enforce the laws. And also, we need to rethink accountability, because just locking everybody up for a long time doesn't seem to be working. We need to look at how do we do restorative justice and how do we do the healing? Because there's so much pain and trauma in these communities that are plagued by gun violence. And so we really encourage everyone to come to the table and put everything out there, from accountability to prevention. And that's the only way that we're going to be able to keep gun violence going down. And it's encouraging that after 2 years of the media cycle rightfully being concerned about a large spike in gun violence, last year we saw one of the largest declines year over year in gun violence. Cities and states that have been investing in prevention and strengthening gun laws are seeing a much deeper decrease in gun violence than the states that are weakening their gun laws. The evidence shows that what we're doing is working. We just need to continue to pass it state by state until there's enough pressure on Congress to finally close all the loopholes and make sure we have strong foundational gun laws across the country.
That's a really important point. Yes, this past year we saw a very steep decline in gun violence in many cities and communities across the country. Can you speak to why that is and the combination of forces, maybe perhaps through CVI or changes in state laws that may have contributed to this trend?
Actually, forthcoming research from the Center for American Progress shows that we looked at the 300 largest cities in the country. And if you remember that the gun laws are written at the state level, the gun lobby has prevented cities from being able to pass their own gun laws. And so cities that are in states with stronger gun laws and that have invested in prevention, they saw about 19% decrease in gun violence, whereas cities and states that haven't increased their gun laws, that have F ratings on their gun laws, they only saw maybe a 5% decrease. So we're really seeing this growing diverge between the cities that are doing the right things, cities like Baltimore that's invested a lot in the community violence intervention, and states like New York State that are really investing in victim compensation, so that way when someone is victimized, they can get the hospital services and the healing services they need. California passed a tax where a percentage of all tax on revenue from ammunition and firearms is going towards prevention and helping law enforcement close cases. So we're really encouraging states not to rest on their laurels. This 1 year drop is really encouraging. We're showing that it's working, but we need to continue to encourage states to strengthen their gun laws in this legislative season, because otherwise we're going to have a blue America that is much safer and a red America that gun violence continues to be not only at the city level, but the rural level, where we see about 8 out of the 10 most dangerous counties are actually rural places like in Arkansas.
Any final thoughts for listeners? Anything you want to add?
The last thing I would add is one of the most exciting things in the gun violence prevention movement is this massive federal investment in community violence intervention and prevention programming. This is not a new program. Since the 50s and 60s, there's been, especially in African-American communities, there's been these credible messengers that are helping reach young people that might be involved in violence and showing them a different path. But it wasn't until about the year 2000, when we started putting more money as a public health approach. And then just a couple of years ago, we've seen this massive federal investment, whether it's through ARPA money or through the Bipartisan Safer Community Act. But there's going to be a fiscal cliff coming, and a lot of this federal money is going to dry up. And we really need to find other ways to support programs that are working on the ground to prevent gun violence and making sure that they are well-paid, well-trained, well-supported, and that when this money dries up, that we don't just start closing these programs that are having an impact and then seeing gun violence increase. So we really encourage individuals to talk to their policymakers, their elected officials. It's still, community violence intervention is still a new phrase, just because people don't know what it is, and we're trying to demystify it. But if people listening to this feel moved, they should really talk to their local, state, and federal officials about how to provide more sustainable funding for years to come.
That was Nick Wilson, the Director of Gun Violence Prevention at the Center for American Progress. You can find out more about their work and Nick and all of our guests at peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com. Lastly, we'll close out today's show with another segment from the Streets, Beats, and Peace podcast on gun violence prevention in Chicago. Hosts Billy Deal and Rodney Phillips talk with guests James Mitchell and Nidra Turner of the Metropolitan Peace Initiatives about outreach work in the community violence intervention space. As we mentioned earlier, one of the most powerful aspects of this program is how these outreach workers were themselves once perpetrators of violence in their communities, but through the combined efforts of the justice system and community violence intervention, they've transformed their lives to improve their community and help others.
Now, we know that being in these streets can sometimes put you in uncompromising situations, right? We know it's real dangerous out there. We've had outreach workers shot, some killed on the job, some that we know. Why do you do this work?
The violence needs to stop. I saw a lot of it, like I said, the street that I lived on. I used to walk out the door and a body right there, right in front of the crib. See a couple of people get shot, my friend kids there, my kids' friends, you know, getting killed out here in these streets. I do the work to try to uplift the other kids, encourage them that it's not about violence all the time. You know, you could go to school, get you an education, and you could probably, you know, become one of the peace initiatives that we are. You know, like, it's just try to keep these kids and not even just the kids, just the people out in the streets, off the streets, from doing the violence and killing other families and, you know, all that. That's why I do this work, because I love the work that I do and I love to help and support.
How would somebody else get into this field? Say if somebody want to do this work, right, but they don't have the connections that you have to pull you in, how would somebody else try and get into this? Do they see y'all out in the field and say, I want to do this work and get involved, or come and volunteer? How will somebody get involved in this?
Like a lot of people that get involved, like basically, like we be talking about the LTO, rather you need to have the LTO in your areas, you know.
For the people that don't know what LTO mean, what does that
LTO
mean?
LTO means license to operate. You have that connection in certain areas and so certain communities where you that connect where you from. So you could start off as a participant. We had some people started off, you know, as participants, you know, getting their stuff together, come in and getting their needs. They have that support from us. And majority of the participants be from the community. So they see what we out here doing, want to change. They want to change. So we'll start them off, you know, a little slow. We have a program, too, called FLIP, Flatlining Violence Inspiring Peace. They could start off as a flip worker where you're policing your own community. You're the one up in the community where the people could walk up to. You're the one up in the community that could de-escalate, you know, conflicts. Like, you policing your own community, helping your own community, trying to keep the police out the community and keep the peace. So you can start off being an outreach worker, you know, from there, work your way up.
Headlines and statistics is one thing. You know, on the news, they show the violence every day, but they never highlight the good. They never highlight the work that y'all do. So for both of y'all, I want to hear some of the success stories y'all had in doing this work.
I'm one of them. But it's more, right? Like, it's a bunch of people like me and Nike. We not just like these two special people who've been changed by the work. It's a bunch of us. So I got two participants. One of them, he was one of the target individuals. He was a victim of violence, and then he was also a driver of violence. Like, he was, this is what he did. And he had got so used to doing it to, I remember one time he was like, man, I'm going to die doing this. And I'm like, Joe, you don't have to. And I'm like, look at me. I ain't dead. And I got him to start, man. I got him into flip. He started off as a flip worker, like Nike was saying, and it gave him a chance to police his own community. And he liked it. He liked being the person that people came to. So after he ended up graduating flip, you know, we came up with a plan, a success plan, like, hey, what you want to do, and let's get to it. And he was like, man, like, you know, I want to be able to make money. I want to be able to take care of my family. And he liked to drive. So he came to the program. We got him into a CDL class through WHEEL. He ended up graduating, getting his license. We supported him all the way through, helped him find a job. He's driving for Pepsi right now, today.
That's dope.
And there's a bunch of them like that. I'm pretty sure Nike got a bunch of them like that too. So the work working.
So I have one. He started off as a participant. He became a flip worker. During his flip position, he was doing well. He got promoted up to an outreach worker. Mind you, he had just got out of prison for serving 20 years, and he came back, you know, on the right track in his community. So he became an outreach worker. He entered the MPA class. And from there, you know, he just continued to do good and, you know, be great and work on, you know, his issues that, you know, he learned from the academy and all that stuff. And now he is the supervisor for the outreach, the street outreach team. So, you know, the work is working. It's all about, you know, the individual and what we out here doing in the streets as well. You know, being that support system and, you know, showing them that the work can be done. So it's working. We out here doing the work.
That's dope. And I got one last question before we wrap this up. This is for you because you actually was out in the hornet's nest during the crisis response. And you was one of the people that got maced, right? How hard and how difficult was it for you to stay, to remain focused and stick to the script after being maced by them kids down there?
It's definitely a challenge. I'm not a robot, so it's definitely a challenge. But what, like I say, like, these are kids. Like, I don't consider them just somebody kids. These are kids, mine, you and too. So I know the things that go into trauma. Like we briefly said, we understand CBI, we take it, and these classes and these tools give us the things to deal with that. So although I was upset and half blind, I still know we got a mission at hand, you feel me? And let's get these kids home safe.
That was a segment from the Streets, Beats, and Peace podcast on gun violence prevention in Chicago. You can get more details on all of our guests on this topic today, as well as find links to their work, their organizations, at peacetalksradio.com, where you can hear all the programs in our series dating back to 2003. You can see photos of our guests, read and share transcripts, sign up for our podcast, and make a donation to keep this program going into the future. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. Today's episode was produced by correspondent Emily Cohen with support from supervising producer Jessica Tickton. Our work is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from the Albuquerque Community Foundation Ties Fund. Nola Daves Moses is our nonprofit executive director. Ali Adelman composed and performs our theme music. For co-founder Suzanne Kreider and the rest of our team, I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks so much for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.